and welcome to this week's edition of House of Comments podcast. My name is Emma Burnell and I blog at the Scarlet Standard, a Labour supporting blog. And I'm joined today, as always, by my friend and fellow commentator, Mark Thompson, who's a Lib Dem blogger. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you doing?
Very well. Thank you very much. So this week, a few weeks late, we have seen the announcement, the arrival of the alternative Queen's speech. Bills put forward by the Tory right, including bringing back the death penalty, Margaret Thatcher Day. I'm trying to think of some of the other particular highlights.
Oh, I've got them all written down in front of me, Emma. I've prepared for this.
Oh, well done. You are more prepared than me. But I have been making policy in Birmingham. I've only just got home, so.
Oh, that's you're excused. I've had nothing better to do than sit down and read through 40-odd...
I have read the titles of the bills and just gone, I don't want to know anymore.
Oh, no, don't get me wrong, I haven't read the details. In fact, all I've read is the titles and then the summary that Mark Ferguson put on Labour List.
Yes.
Which I thought was quite a handy little crib sheet.
Indeed.
I mean, it's... Well, the first thing is I actually agree with some of them. Let's start with the positives. So... I think this one talks about all criminals would have to serve their full sentences. So I said on Twitter that I agree with that one. But then a few people challenged me on it. And I kind of realised what I agree with is that if someone's going to serve 2.5 years and they know they're going to serve 2.5 years, even though they say they're going to be given five, they should just be given 2.5 years. It should just be clear. But a few people pointed out that what the Tory right want is for them to actually serve 5 years under those circumstances. And that isn't what I'm advocating. So I sort of agree with it on one level, but I probably don't agree with what they meant.
I think in the light of the Stuart Hall sentencing, there is a definite need to relook at sentencing policy, which doesn't seem to be very clear and does seem to be very confused a lot of the time. But I would rather do that in the round rather than simply saying everyone must serve the maximum penalty and the full sentence, because there are reasons why we have discounts.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But my view would be that you would have what your sentence is, and the sentence would be what you would get if you had good behaviour. And then if you don't have good behaviour, then they add on to the sentence afterwards and do it that way around. I think that would have more public confidence, because at the moment, people hear someone's going to get, 12 years. But in their mind, they're thinking, what does that actually mean? Will they 6 years, 5 years, 4 years? And people don't know. And, it's understandable why you wouldn't know, unless you're actually a lawyer or, an expert in this area, then you wouldn't know, would you?
No, absolutely. And this is another part of it, is that it is a very, very complicated system. It's almost undemocratically complicated.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then, of course, into that gap steps the Mail and, the Sun. They probably distort and spin on the other side and make it sound like it's a lot worse than it is. So if it was just clearer, there would be less scope for those sorts of shenanigans. Some of the other things I agreed with, they talk about amalgamating the Scottish office, the Wales office and Northern Ireland office. I sort of agree that they could probably look at doing something there, because obviously those parts of the country now have their own devolved administration. So I think there's scope there. Adopting all new roads should be adopted by the local highways authority. I think that's fair enough. BBC licence fee would no longer be a crime not to pay the licence fee. I think that's right. I don't think people should be criminalised for not paying the licence fee.
Criminalised for not paying for anything else.
Sorry?
You're criminalised for not paying for anything else that you receive the service of.
So if you've got a Sky television subscription and then you don't pay it, I suppose they cut you off, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I'm sympathetic to that, let's put it that way. Maybe I haven't fully thought it through. I haven't got my own manifesto, you see, Emma. I'm just kind of going down and putting red circles around the things I think I agree with.
I mean, of all the people who right now should be cross with the BBC, it's probably me. But I still believe in a publicly funded straight broadcaster, because we have the best news in the world. And I know that because I've watched other people's news.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I do as well. I still agree with a fully funded, state broadcaster. And again, it's one of these things where I agree with the headline. I probably don't agree with the intention of the people who drafted it. They talk about prime ministerial replacement and order of succession if the PM is killed or incapacitated. I absolutely agree with that. There's a few others I agree with. But basically, most of them I don't agree with. So let's just go through some of the ones I don't agree with. Charitable status for religious institutions. So it assumes that all religious institutions are automatically charities.
So, yeah, basically the Scientologist charter.
Yeah, exactly. Anyone who just decides that they're going to call themselves a religion and then suddenly get charitable status. I'm sorry, you know, bullshit alert. I don't understand where that one's come from at all.
It's around here. What really, really worries me is as people get poorer, there are two things that are popping up. Storefront churches and pawn shops. And I'm really concerned that poor people are being massively exploited. And if we were to make religion even more able to make something you can make money out of, get taxes and status for, I just think it would get worse and worse.
Yeah, I agree. Well, don't get me started on religion, Emma. It's not something I tend to bang on about very much on this podcast, but yeah, I have quite strong views. They want to privatise the BBC, so that's number 27 on that. So 16 is about the BBC licence fee, but then they show their true colours in number 27. Privatise the BBC and hand shares to all licence fee payers. They also want to abolish the office of the Deputy Prime Minister, which I think is just a snub to Nick Clegg, because I don't think they actually want to abolish the office of Deputy Prime Minister, because that office is just at the whim of the Prime Minister. There wasn't one for quite a long time.
No.
I think between 1990 and 1995, for example, there wasn't one. And then when Major did his, you know, cards on the table thing and Redwood challenged him, in order to keep Heseltine on side, he made him Deputy Prime Minister for the last couple of years of his Prime Ministership. And then when Blair got in, it was...
It was Prescott.
It was Prescott, but when Brown got in, he didn't have one. It was sort of Peter Mandelson, but he wasn't officially Deputy Prime Minister. And then, of course, now we've got Nick Clegg. So our constitution is so malleable that the idea you're going to abolish a specific office is just nonsense. That just doesn't make any sense at all. And then this one, sexual impropriety in employment. Abolishes sexual...
The Gropers Charter.
Exactly. Abolishes sexual harassment cases in the workplace.
Hey, it'd make things a lot easier if you were a Lib Dem peer.
I put those kind of Batman things to come up on the side of my head.
Kapow.
Yeah, well, isn't that just totally ridiculous? I mean, what have we been fighting for?
It's ridiculous. It's deeply, deeply insulting. The idea that in this day and age, as we are starting, is starting to become clearer and clearer is that these issues have not gone anywhere. You know, the last big parliamentary scandal was about people saying this happens a lot. And then a bunch of old white men go, oh, we should be allowed to pinch people's bottoms if we want to in the workplace, and we shouldn't have to go be bullied about it. Absolutely disgraceful.
Yeah, and I mean, it's you look at this list and you see the odd thing, and you think, well, that's fair enough. And then you see something like that and you just think, what planet are these people on?
Yeah.
You know, we've spent the last 50 years or 40 years, you know, trying to get to a place where things like this, okay, they're probably never going to be eradicated, but, you know, society frowns upon this sort of stuff a lot more than it used to. It did. I think it did used to be, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, almost seen as a bit of, you know, a bit of harmless fun by quite a lot of people. And I think it's become recognised in more recent years that that is just bollocks, frankly.
Yeah.
And the idea they want to row back from that. Yes. Crazy. And there's loads of other stuff in here as well, but I suppose I'm more interested really in the wider politics of this. I did notice that Mark Ferguson, again on Labour List, wrote a piece where he said, is this the true face of the Tory party? And I got slightly irritated by that, because I don't think this is the true face of the Tory party. I think it's the true face of a wing, an element of the Tory party. But, you know, the leadership of the Tory party doesn't agree with the vast majority of this either. I don't think it's certainly not where the centre ground of the Tory party is. It's not where the leadership is either. Whether that will be the case after 2015 is maybe a different question, but it's certainly not the case now. I think I did a blog post where I said, is Dennis Skinner the you know, the real face of the Labour Party? It seems
the problem is that there is a really strong element of this in the Tories, in the same way that there is a strong element of the left. They're not the extreme left. They're all in the SWP or various other splinter groups. But, you know, a certain amount of the Labour Party would renationalise quite a lot of things. I'm not saying 50%. I'm not even saying 20%. But at least 10% would. and would go along to that extreme. And they are part and parcel of the party. I think that what this has made me think of, and this conversation, is this the true face of the Tory party? It brought me back to having read, which I have read now, Andrew Adonis's book about 5 days in May.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking, and something Ed Ball said at the policy forum yesterday, it made me think about this as well. There was an element to the way the Lib Dems were talking, which was as if every Labour MP was basically like Tom Harris and were completely unreasonable over PR, and every Tory MP was David Cameron. Neither of those things are true.
No, but
both of those things exist within their parties.
No, but the big difference is that it only took a few Tom Harris's, a very small number of Tom Harris's, to make the deal unworkable. Whereas actually, Cameron could have a rebellion of 20, 30 of his backbenchers, and the government would still get its business through. So there was it came down to the numbers, really.
But that's not, I'm not talking about the numbers, I'm talking about the way the discussion was held. The tone of the discussion was, Labour are all these mad headbangers, the Tories have changed and they're lovely and cuddly and liberal now.
I think that's a fairly caricatured way of looking at it. I don't think anyone, I certainly didn't think that, and I don't really know any other Lib Dems who did think that the Tories are all nice and cuddly. I think I saw one description around about the time, I think it was from a Lib Dem, who said that, you know, when Clegg and Cameron are kind of, you know, arms around each other, you know, just outside number 10, that Cameron will be whispering in his ear, "I'm going to fucking destroy you," which kind of resonated with me a little bit, because I did sort of think that...
Because it has.
Well, this was back in 2010. I mean, obviously I didn't know for definite what was going to happen. But, you know, the Tories know what to do with power. And, you know, there's a reason why for the last 100 years they've been in power for the vast majority of it alone. You know, because they know what to do with it, or at least they did used to know what to do with it.
The Tories seem to have lost the habit of being in power, really. Quite a lot of them, quite quickly. This alternative Queen's speech is basically a way of saying we'd rather be Tory than in power.
Yeah, and Andrew Rawnsley did an interesting piece on this in the Observer today, where basically he was saying, don't they want to be in power? Because regardless of whether this is a small faction, and, you know, let's be fair here, this is, I think it was 4 Tory MPs who were involved in writing this alternative Queen's speech. You know, you could look upon that and say, well, it's only a few of them. But actually, this has had massive coverage, and they knew it was going to have massive coverage.
Yeah.
And it's just, they don't care.
No.
And Tories used to be more disciplined than that, and they're not anymore.
No, they're absolutely not disciplined at all as a party. And that's a real problem, particularly when, you know, you are a governing party that does not have a majority, and you're going to face another election.
Yeah.
You know, lack of discipline, lack of message consistency, lack of understanding as to what you're there to do. None of these things are the things that are going to give the Tories a majority next time.
I mean, what I don't understand, though, is that they don't seem to understand the lessons of history, because if a broadly right-wing agenda was going to win them elections, it would have worked in 2001 or 2005, and it didn't. You know, they lost massively in 2001 and 2005. You know, in 2010, OK, they didn't win outright, but they are in government, and, you know, Cameron tacked to the centre. Now, their view is he wasn't right-wing enough, but frankly, if he'd been more right-wing, they probably wouldn't even be in government now. I don't understand what there is that they're not getting about this.
Well, there are still some people who believe that Labour's 1983 manifesto was too much of a compromise with the electorate. There are just people who will convince themselves that what's really needed is something red in tooth and claw, or blue in tooth and claw in this case. And actually, all you need is one last push. If you build it, they will come.
It's a kind of fascinating psychological, sociological phenomenon, because there's probably a lot of groupthink going on here, isn't there? They just associate...
Everybody they know thinks this is perfectly sensible stuff.
Exactly, and the dinner parties they go to, and the soirees and the cocktail parties, and, you know, most people agree with them, and therefore they can't really understand how anyone could ever disagree with it. And even though a policy platform like that, I'd be lucky to get 10 or, you know, 15% of the vote.
Yeah.
Mm.
And they seem to be trying to appeal to UKIP, UKIP-type voters, or their idea of a UKIP-type voter. It's a bit more complicated than most of us think. But actually, that's not where the battle is. You know, UKIP might lose a lot of votes to their right to UKIP, but they'll lose their seats to Labour.
Mm.
And, you know, that's something they just don't seem to be prepared to understand the compromises you need to make to stop that happening.
Yeah, but of course that's down to the crazy first-past-the-post system, isn't it, Emma?
Oh, God, Mark, how far are we in?
That was actually a cue to move on to the next subject.
Indeed, indeed. Well, I mean, actually coming back to something that we were talking about in that discussion and the sexism that is still inherent in society. One of the things that's happened this week is these pictures that came out last weekend of Nigella Lawson being held by the throat by her husband, and the issues around domestic violence that have been sort of cascading out ever since.
Yeah.
And some of the reaction to what happened and people's opinions of what happened have been quite disturbing. You know, it's between a husband and wife. It's nobody's business but theirs. Nobody knows what happens in a marriage but the people in the marriage. You know, domestic violence is a crime. It is something, you know, it is violence. It's, you know, it is everybody's business. It's society's business when somebody is holding their wife by the throat in a restaurant. Because if that's what they're doing in public, God knows what's happening in private. And, you know, this is something that we should be much, much better at being up in arms about. And if we continue this attitude, it's not our business, then we won't step in, and we should step in when we see somebody being threatened like this.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, Clegg was asked about this, wasn't he, on his call-in show on LBC the other day. And he kind of hemmed and hawed, and he used the word fleeting, which I don't think was a good choice of words at all. I mean, I think what he was trying to get at was, you know, that if he'd have been in that situation, then he'd have glanced over and seen it and then glanced again, and maybe it was just a split-second thing, and you might not even quite realise what you'd seen. But that's not really how it came across, and it's certainly not how it's been reported. I think his point was...
Clegg's instincts when it comes to gender politics are really, really bad.
Yeah, I saw you...
He never gets it right.
I saw you saying that on Twitter. I mean, I... You know, if I'd been asked the question Clegg was asked on the radio, the question he was specifically asked was, would you step in?
Mm.
I'm not sure I could answer honestly and say, yes, I would. I think it depends what I'd have seen. I would like to think that my instinct would be, if I saw a woman being physically attacked, that I would. But I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where you think you've seen something, you look again, and you're not even sure if it is what you'd seen. You know, and it could, if it literally was like that, then I don't know. Another thing that I read as well is that apparently it can be a really bad idea to step in and intervene in a situation like that, because the person who is assaulting is trying to assert control. And if you go in and take that control away, then later on when they go back home, you know, there might be a much worse assault as a result of the kind of pent up frustration. So it's a very, very complicated, difficult issue, isn't it, and situation?
It is a very complicated and difficult situation. I know people who've gone through it, and they do need outside support, because one of the hardest parts is that this is the person that you've chosen to spend your life with.
Yeah.
This is the person you've chosen to give all your love to. And it can be a very, very lonely place when that is abused.
Mm.
And so outside support in whatever form it takes. And if an abuser is going to abuse, an abuser is going to abuse, to be quite honest. You know, it doesn't need... One excuse would be one excuse, but, you know, so many different things trigger abuse that I think that notion that you could be making it worse later, it doesn't convince me.
I read an article, I can't remember where it was now. It was after the pictures had been published, so it was in kind of, you know, response to that. Mm. It was from a woman who had suffered domestic abuse for, I think, about a year or 18 months in the first relationship she'd had. So she was, like, I think, 40 now. Mm. But this was when she was, like, 18, 19, so it was her first relationship. And she was just talking about how, you know, at first, you know, she would do something and then, you know, her boyfriend would hit her, and it would be because she'd done this certain thing. And I can't remember exactly what the example was, but it was something where she tidied something away and he slapped her. And then later on there was something, and then she didn't tidy it away, and then he slapped her because she hadn't tidied it away.
Yeah.
And she said at that point, I realised that there actually was no logic to it. There was no. It's not like I could ever get it right because that wasn't what it was about.
No, absolutely. Until the abuser gets help, they will be an abuser.
Yeah.
I'm not going to completely disregard it, but I'm very sceptical about the argument that stepping in makes things worse. I think what Clegg should have said is the same thing that we'd all say if we're honest, that I would like to hope that I would.
Yeah.
I like to hope that I would have the courage to do so. I would be frightened because there'd be violence and violence frightens me.
Mm.
I would like to hope I would step in and say something and make sure that the person under attack, or at least try to get somebody who is possibly bigger and fitter and stronger than me to step in, but take some action.
Mm.
Taking it out from the context of the situation, some of the commentary about this has been so depressing, in the same way that the Tory Taliban and their Groper's Charter, we just seem to be going backwards in terms of gender equality at the moment so rapidly. It really frightens me. Really worries me that we are becoming a society that is too comfortable with poor behaviour in terms of gender equality.
But do you think we are going backwards, though? Because
Yes, it really feels that way.
Most of the coverage I've seen of the Nigella situation has been largely supportive of her, and it's actually provoked a very important debate about this. And I would hope that, like I say, that comment piece that I read, and there's been plenty of others, and I'm sure it's been all over the TV stations and the radio stations talking about this, that it's the sort of thing that is being covered in a way that is in the direction that I think that we would both want. So although there are still some reactionary elements in society, I would hope that they're being exposed to what they are, which is a fairly extreme reaction, definitely not the mainstream anymore like it was 30 or 40 years ago.
The Evening Standard, who is Charles Saatchi's employer, have run piece after piece about how it was basically nothing. He only took the caution because it would stop all the embarrassment. Yeah, what happens between a man and wife is nobody's business but theirs. And, you know, there are the fact that it is a debate. I mean, it's great that issues have been raised in the public consciousness, but there is a debate happening. And, you know, that means there are two sides to it. And I don't see that there are two sides to this issue.
Well, I mean, I agree with you, but it's not surprising that there is a debate about it, because there isn't an absolute uniform consensus across everyone in society on this. There should be, but there isn't. But I think over time we will see that shift happening. We already have seen it. Maybe we'll never get to a point where everyone, you know, agrees with with the view that domestic violence is wrong and is our business. But, you know, there's far more nowadays that think it than used to. And I don't think we're going in the other direction, is what I'm saying.
I am not specifically with domestic violence, but in terms of gender equality, things like the £5 note and the move to take off Elizabeth Rye, who was the only woman on a banknote, and put on Winston Churchill. Because obviously, if Winston Churchill wasn't on the banknotes, we'd all completely forget who he was. And, you know, we're not absolutely surrounded by, like, reminders of Churchill all the bloody time.
Well, be careful what you wish for, because Thatcher will be on a banknote soon.
Well, you know, I'm not a big fan of Thatcher, but it would be... I don't think we should make women invisible, either women of the right or women of the left. There is an invisibilisation of women in society, in hierarchies, and it is, I think, getting worse. And it feels to me, as someone who is now reaching middle age and, you know, has been knocking around a bit for a while, it just feels worse than it has been for a long time.
Okay, well, obviously, if that's your perception, and you probably focus more on these issues than I do, you know, I'll be perfectly honest, then, you know, maybe I have to accept that. But that isn't what I've seen, but maybe I'm not looking in the right places.
Well, you don't see it because it's invisible.
Good point.
Okay, so I think we've covered Nigella. I wanted to also bring us on very quickly to a article in the Daily Mail, or is it the Sunday Mail, about a suggestion from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Mark Littlewood, their director there, has written an article for the Mail saying that George Osborne should publish the name and address of every single benefit claimant in the UK. What's your thoughts on this, Mark?
He used to be in the Lib Dems, you know.
See, I'm glad you brought that up, Mark.
I spent a very interesting afternoon with Mark Littlewood a few years ago at Lib Dem conference. It was after some fringe event, and the drink was flowing and the cigarettes were flowing, as I seem to remember. Although I don't drink or smoke, but there are a few of us there, and he's very good company actually. But I think it would be a stretch to say that his views are in any way representative of the mainstream of liberal or Lib Dem thinking. I think there's a reason why he was appointed director of the Institute of Economic Affairs. Because that is a fairly right-wing think tank, isn't it, in terms of its views. My personal view is that that's crazy. You can't publish people's names and addresses just because they're receiving benefits. That's just not right at all. And I suspect we're going to agree on this. This might be a very short discussion.
Yeah, I mean, it is completely crazy. But the thing is, it's written from this perspective, as if everybody on benefits is A, on workless benefits or disability benefit, whereas, I mean, is he going to publish the name of every pensioner in the country? And it just has this, it continues this attitude to benefits as if they are this alien thing that nobody in their lives really knows or understands, except for those scroungers who get them. When actually, most of us will at some point in our life have a state benefit, not least because we'll live to be old enough to claim a pension, we hope.
Yeah, I mean, he's probably excluding pensions from this, isn't he?
Hasn't, I did read the whole article, and he doesn't mention pensions, so he doesn't specifically excluded it.
I'm sure
that's true in the report that it's based on.
I'm sure he is excluding pensions, because the thrust of this is that it's the scroungers, isn't it?
Yeah.
He wouldn't consider pensioners to be scroungers. I'm really not sure there's much more I can say about this. It's a terrible idea.
It is a terrible... who is he... I would not expect the Liberal Democrats to countenance this at all, because it's not very liberal.
Well, exactly. It's almost as illiberal as you can get, publishing people's names and addresses.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of where the Liberal Democrats fall economically, that's one thing. But in terms of where they fall on privacy,
exactly,
it's pretty clear that this isn't up their street.
Yeah.
But it just seems like I don't understand why the Institute of Economic Affairs are spending money to promote an idea as nutty as this, and what's in it for them?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose they'll get lots of coverage from it. And although I'm sure they don't think this will ever be implemented, maybe they think a watered-down version of it might be at some point in the future. You know, I don't know, maybe more details.
You think it's like a balloon?
Sorry?
They're just flag flying for now and seeing what happens.
They can't possibly believe that this will ever be implemented. But they must think that even if it just nudges the debate slightly more in their direction, maybe it's worth doing.
Yes, I mean, because so far the debate around benefits has been so well-tempered and reasonable.
Well, yeah, and this just adds more fuel to the fire, doesn't it? I mean, I was reading some of the comments underneath the piece, and, you know, it's the Mail, so unsurprisingly, you know, there were quite a lot of people agreeing with what Mr. Littlewood had said. But actually, you know, it was quite heartening to see there were a number of comments that completely disagreed as well. So even for the Mail, this is going a bit too far, it would seem.
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, Richard Littlejohn, Melanie Phillips, who was superb on Question Time this week. If you really want to disprove your moniker of Mad Mel, don't spend about 3 minutes ranting at the audience about the fact that they're paranoid.
I actually missed it. I did intend to watch it, and then I got caught up with something else, and I've not got round to it. But, Melanie Phillips, Boris Johnson and Russell Brand, they certainly know how to pick the guests, don't they,
she spun them out a little bit. I think having them all on at once was a bit, you know, they've kind of, which one was going to get to be mad? Boris was almost completely disintegrated, because he didn't get to be the A-game star. That was Russell Brand.
Yeah.
Russell Brand's shtick is Boris's shtick in many ways, just from a leftist perspective. Better dressed.
Yes, it's true, actually. Yeah, they're both kind of English gentlemanly fops, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, once Russell Brand showed Boris how to really do that, Boris had nowhere to go.
Well, maybe Boris...
Very interesting.
Maybe Boris will have learnt a thing or two.
Maybe.
Maybe he'll add some more stuff to his repertoire, so we can look forward to that.
Heroin.
Yeah, I didn't mean that, but anyway.
So, yes, it was quite quite the performance from Melanie Phillips. There was, I mean, it really was just cringeworthy. Watching it through the gaps in your fingers time.
Mm. Maybe I won't bother watching it then, because I don't really like seeing people go into complete meltdown on television.
Yeah, I mean, it was uncomfortable. And it was, it was Question Time, which, as we know, is a very competitive format anyway. Mm. And it became a sort of real ding-dong between the audience and the panel members and the panel members and the panel members. And, it was just basically a brawl, which neatly brings me on to our last topic, which is the behaviour of politicians in Parliament and during things particularly like PMQs, where they're, just shouting and jeering and getting very angry with each other. And, the public will constantly tell you that they hate this and this is not what they want to see from parliamentarians. But parliamentarians will tell you that if people want to come into Parliament, the time they want to come and see them, their constituents ask for tickets or what have you, is at 12 noon on a Wednesday.
Yeah, and I mean, I have been to see PMQs. I was going to say a couple of times, actually. I did get tickets a couple of times. One time I couldn't go. So I've actually been to see it once from the Strangers Gallery. And yes, that was the time that I wanted to get tickets for. But that's because that's when the Prime Minister's being questioned. Not because they jeer and shout and all the rest of it at each other. I hate that stuff. I've hated that for years. I didn't get interested in and eventually involved in politics because of the way MPs behave in the chamber, very much in spite of all of that. And the thing that's kicked off the coverage of this more recently has been Julian Huppert, Lib Dem MP, who was elected in 2010. And apparently every time he stands up now to speak, straight away you get a load of people shouting Muppet at him and singing the Manamana, do-do-do-do-do, that song from the Muppets at him. And just basically trying to drown him out. And apparently one of the problems is that he tends to go on a little bit.
He is a blowhard, and it must be said. I mean, I don't think they should be singing at him in the mother of all parliaments.
That's another thing that I hate about PMQs, because you see it. Someone stands up to ask a question, and if it's longer than about 8 or 9 or 10 seconds, you start to get this kind of... And then a kind of crescendo builds up until they're drowned out by the time they get to about 15 or 20 seconds. I know that there's only a limited amount of time, but, give them a chance to actually give the question. If they're out of order, if they're just speechifying, then the speaker will step in and stop them. There's no need for the backbenchers to be doing this. And it's just unseemly. How do they think this comes across?
We're talking about some of the times that... I mean, I don't think this is about... I don't want to turn this around on Julian Huppert. I don't want to make this a defence or attack on him. He does go on a bit.
Lots of MPs
that's
do.
That's all right. Lots of MPs go on a bit and are a bit dull.
Yeah, exactly. Lots of them do. And, it shouldn't be a prerequisite of being an MP and being in the chamber to be massively charismatic and to be able to, distill your question into a 5-word soundbite. It's supposed to be a debating chamber. And I really wonder, okay, you do get all these parliamentarians who say, yeah, but that's really, although the public say that actually they love PMQs and, a bit of ding-dong and it gets the troops, it gets the blood up for the troops and it shows who's winning the argument. No, it doesn't. It just looks like a bunch of public schoolboys playing stupid games, insulting each other, shouting at each other across the chamber. Imagine if you were in a business meeting and you stood up to make your point, and within 10 seconds the rest of the people around the room, around the table, were drowning you out with jeers. It just doesn't happen. It's so unreflective of our society. It's just untrue.
Parliament is completely old-fashioned and ridiculous in so many ways. When I went to Strasbourg and visited the European Parliament, it was just so much more sophisticated, the way that they ran their debates, the way they voted, the way they sit in a circle rather than in this sort of oppositional way that we have in Parliament.
I presume Daniel Hannan and Nigel Farage weren't speaking when you were there then.
Hannan was there. I didn't see Farage, much as we spent most of the weekend hoping we'd bump into him. I didn't see Farage, but...
No, it's just they're both famous for having, I think, used probably more the kind of debating tactics that tend to be seen more in the House of Commons than in the European Parliament, aren't they?
Well, Daniel Hannan was asleep, or at least looked asleep from where I was sat.
Right.
And I don't think it was a particularly controversial debate.
No, and to be fair, I mean, let's be fair, probably most of the time, when if you were to just drop into the Strangers Gallery, actually it would be perfectly amicable.
Yeah,
I mean, most debates are.
We are talking about a few occasions where people have rubbed each other up the wrong way, and the big set pieces.
Yeah, but the problem is...
next week during the... whatever George Osborne has to say.
Or whatever, yeah. Yeah, but it is those set pieces that get the coverage. So, you know, the other debates don't get the coverage on the news. You don't get a 20-second snippet of what happened in the fisheries debate on the news, but you do get a 20-second snippet of what happened in PMQs. And every time there's jeering, there's heckling, there's laughing and pointing. And it's just so pathetic. And it's not going to change, is it? I mean, I've kind of realised this now. No matter how ridiculous it looks, that ain't going to change, because the people involved in it love it. They absolutely love it.
They do. They all do. And, you know, regardless of party or persuasion, you know, it's part of their job. They part of who they are in terms of being aggressive fighters for their politics. So they see it as very much a key part of that. And it's not going to change. It won't change because we're not going to change the format of Parliament.
Well, this is the thing, because actually, aren't they clearing out of Parliament in a couple of years' time? Are they going to have to completely redo it pretty much from the ground up because of kind of structural problems with the building?
I believe so, yeah. But
so that would be a perfect opportunity. They're going to have to decamp to somewhere else anyway. So why can't they decamp somewhere with a structure that's more akin to like they have in the European Parliament or in the Scottish Parliament or the Welsh Assembly, something that is better designed for the modern age? Because
Parliament is inside those people as well as those people being inside Parliament, and they will build Parliament in its own image.
I know, it's a slightly rhetorical question. I kind of know the answer. But actually, if you're looking for a practical point at which you could do something about this, a couple of years' time is about the time. One thing I wanted to ask you about this, Emma, because this is an extraordinarily masculine thing, isn't it? A very kind of public school boy thing.
It drives me crazy. It really is. And women are expected to do it more because to show that they can.
Exactly. So Thatcher was always seen as being very good at a very good performer in the Commons, wasn't she?
Mm. And you're expected to be more macho as a woman just because you haven't got the innate low voice and strong build, although I have.
Yeah, but that's what it is. So, you know, maybe we've talked about this a lot on previous podcasts, trying to get the number of women in Parliament. Maybe if we can reach a tipping point where we eventually get to 30-40%, or maybe 50%, I mean, that's really what we're aiming for, maybe slightly more than 50%, because women are actually more in the population than men, aren't they? And if we could get to that point, maybe we would see things naturally change. It's just that maybe the kind of women who eventually get into Parliament are the ones, because of the way they have to get there, that maybe this thing will just perpetuate even if that was to happen.
Possibly. I mean, I think that at the moment women are brought through by a large groups of men who tell them this is how it's done.
Yeah.
If we can get to that situation where we're a bit more evenly balanced, perhaps the women can say to the next generation, this is how you might want to do it in future. Fingers crossed.
We can only hope.
We can only hope. I just wanted to end on one final note, which is I've just seen some breaking news that the condition of Nelson Mandela in hospital is now critical. I just thought it might be worth just having a quick moment to reflect on, for me, an absolute political hero, someone who gave his life to an absolutely essential struggle and, you know, won that struggle, which is not something we can all say that we've done.
Absolutely. I mean, he was an iconic figure when I was growing up, and I remember when he was finally released, I watched the pictures live as that happened. And I mean, he was a very strong cultural figure as well. You know, the song by The Specials, wasn't the Free Nelson Mandela, and you know, I was kind of brought up with all of that. I was also brought up, I think there were elements of the Conservative government in the 80s who actually considered him to be a terrorist rather than a freedom fighter. Mm. So there was all that kind of debate as well. But yeah, an absolutely huge figure. And it's very sad if, from what you're saying, it sounds like maybe he's reaching the end of his life now.
We would, every Christmas Eve, my dad would take us as children to the West End, get out of my mum's hair, she could bake mince pies and cry at the carols and things.
Mm.
And we always spent half an hour on the vigil outside the South African embassy.
Oh, fantastic.
And it's a really strong memory for me. You know, from before I had developed memories, that's been happening, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's absolutely intrinsic to my childhood. So he's a real hero, a genuine hero, the kind that we don't really see the like of so often anymore.
Well, yeah, and, you know, he affected such massive change in the country, didn't he? I know it wasn't just him, but he was the figurehead of what happened, wasn't he? The yeah. Ending of apartheid.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, God bless him, or not God, if you prefer. But either way, I just thought it was a fitting ending to the show to salute the man and the legend that is Nelson Mandela.
Absolutely.
And on that note, I'd just like to say thank you, as always, Mark. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you to Audio Boo for hosting the podcast and to Kevin MacLeod for our theme tune. Phenomena. 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 Phenomena.